Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Phaneesh Murthy to the broadcast. Phaneesh is the Chief Executive Officer at iGate Corporation. He joined iGate in 2003 after that company acquired Quintent, an India-based business process outsourcing company that Phaneesh had founded. iGate has won several prestigious awards with Phaneesh at the helm, including the Black Book of Outsourcing's 2008 50 Best Managed Global Outsourcing Vendors. iGate was number 6 in the Knowledge Process Outsourcing category. Additionally, iGate's relationship with Royal Bank of Canada was recently deemed the best partnership between a customer and a vendor by Forbes Everest Awards for Outsourcing Excellence. Prior to founding Quintent, Phaneesh held various leadership positions at Infosys, including head of global sales and marketing from 1995 to 2002. During his time with the company, Phaneesh oversaw a revenue increase from $2 million in revenues to $700 million. Phaneesh was responsible for leading the efforts in building the approximately 300 Fortune 1000 relationships that Infosys has and was responsible for structuring these agreements and contracts. Phaneesh has an MBA from the Indian Institute of Management and the equivalent of a bachelor's degree from the Indian Institute of Technology. I recently caught up with Phaneesh by phone in his Bay Area office. Given iGate's role as an outsourcer, as well as Phaneesh's provocative views about what the typical organizational structure of the future will look like, our conversation focused mostly on principles 1 and 5 of the principles of world-class IT, namely people and external partnerships. Phaneesh, welcome.
Thank you, Peter. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Phaneesh, the topic is world-class IT, and in many ways you seem to be an ideally situated, given your career to date, to comment on such a broad and lofty topic as someone who has worked extensively across the globe. And I'm wondering if at the outset here you can talk to us about your own perspectives of world-class IT, including differences between emerging economies and established economies working in the United States and places like the new powers of India and China.
Sure. I think over the last 20 years, as a broader principle, I think the Indian IT industry has had the mantle of IT leadership, mm-hmm. not in products, but in services. And I think the Indian IT industry has innovated to some extent on what I call an operating model, which is faster, cheaper, better. Prior to 1990, there was significant innovation being done in different areas and services. Case tools is a technology that comes readily to mind, which actually was trying to reduce the amount of contract programming work. However, in the last 18 years, while I think we've been able to do things faster, cheaper, and better, we haven't yet come up with a way to do things differently.
I see.
And I think that is going to be the next challenge over the next 10 years for the world IT industry. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that we should talk about primarily only Indian IT or US IT. Mm-hmm. I think now the models have moved to what I call more a global IT model.
Yes.
We have moved from doing work at one location or two locations to multiple locations where it makes more business sense to do it, where it creates better alignment, and so on. Mm-hmm. So I think overall, I would argue that the services world has improved dramatically. The project management principles have actually gone up dramatically. Mm-hmm. The ability to do distributed project management has gone up dramatically. But it has not fundamentally changed the fact that we need more people to do the job.
Yes.
And I think that over the next 10 years has got to be the focus for the world.
That's very interesting. I'm wondering, I read that you had mentioned that you believed that the trend is actually going to certainly increase towards outsourcing. And you'd mentioned that a corporation of the future might have as much as 75% of its quote-unquote workforce as outsourced positions. And especially in light of this distributed IT workforce that you're describing, I'm wondering for the corporations that employ all these outsourced vendors, which sorts of skills are going to be more meaningfully developed perhaps or more important today, more strategic in the future than they are today? And likewise, what sorts of positions are likely to be handled more broadly externally?
The virtual corporation of the future mm-hmm. is what I believe is going to be the more nimble, the faster to move to market trend, and in fact to create markets.
Okay.
And these companies will end up focusing on a few core competencies or a few competitive advantage items and basically source the rest in some kind of a closer partnership model than a true outsource model. It will be in a closer partnership model, which means skin in the game, much better alignment, much better focus on objectives and things like that. If you look at that principle, therefore, what will be left in these companies of course, is what gives them the competitive advantage. So the ability to try and figure out what is your competitive advantage and make sure that you continuously stay number one in that is going to be a key competence that has to be developed. On the other side, if I look at things like IT, business process, etc., the skills that will be needed within the company versus outside are clearly architecture, design, and an ability to manage by work outcomes rather than by ability to manage work people. So in the past, what has happened is that most managers, we have all become very comfortable when we see 8 people around us working really hard. We actually manage work people. We are not managing work outcomes. So if I look at this whole principle, it has to move towards a much more accountable, metrics-oriented, managing by outcomes. And that's something that I think these managers will have to learn how to do.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is, of course, much, much better appreciation of multiple cultures around the world.
That's a great point.
Because the corporation of the future is not going to be just U.S. and U.S. alone and U.S. sourcing alone. It will involve significant sourcing from multiple parts of the world. And maybe India is one large component, but it could be China, it could be Vietnam, it could be Mexico, it could be any one of these places. Mm-hmm. It could be Eastern Europe, etc. As these companies are global, they will need what I'm calling global sourcing capabilities. And therefore, the ability to manage contracts and the ability to manage commercial relationships with multiple cultures is going to be a lot more complex than what it is today. And consequently, these managers who are going to be more successful in the future will have the capabilities to do that. In some cultures, saying something very directly is appreciated. In some cultures, saying something very directly is not appreciated.
That's a great point.
Therefore, you know, it's one thing to try and say we'll just convert everybody to an American kind of a culture. It's another to make it more successful in a global context. So I think if I were to summarize, I would say that one skill that is keenly needed would be architecture design.
Mm-hmm.
And when I talk about architecture design, I'm actually really talking about the business architecture and the business design, how one process kind of fits into that and what are the technology enablers of that and so on and so forth. And then the second piece, which in my mind is going to be key, is the ability to integrate, manage by outcomes, and manage across cultures.
These are great points, especially as I hear you talking about managing work outcomes. It brings up another point that I had read about you, and that is that you have been working within your own organization to do this to a greater degree, even I believe if I read correctly, taking this to the point of having your clients pay based on outcomes as opposed to time. Is that correct?
Yeah, I believe that for too long, the industry has taken advantage of customers. And I just want to go back, let's say, to the early 90s. The early 90s, the offshore industry, I think, did CIO community a world of good by eliminating, in effect, the 10-year contract, which IBM, CSC, EDS all used to push.
Yes.
So what we used to go on, say, in the offshore industry, we basically proved that you could achieve efficiencies within the first year, 2 years. You don't need a 10-year contract to achieve efficiencies.
Yes.
Which is what the old philosophy was. So by the end of the 90s, nobody signed 10-year contracts because they were happy to sign shorter-term contracts. It gave the CIO more power. It put the CIO in a position where he had his primary partners and vendors re-earning their business every time. And it's a great position to be in as a customer.
Exactly.
However, through these 20-30 years, in effect, the pricing models have not changed dramatically in the sense that they've all been pricing for effort. And I hate to say this, but actually it is an incentive for most companies to be mildly inefficient as long as the customer doesn't catch it.
Yes, exactly.
And that's not a good principle because I actually believe that the customer and the vendor's alignment should be complete. Otherwise, there will always be scope for misunderstandings and problems. Therefore, I came up with this whole philosophy that, you know, the industry should start charging by outcome rather than by effort. And therefore, the customer should only pay for results that they achieve.
That's right.
And these results, while complex to quantify, in some areas are much easier in certain areas. So on a business process, it's very easy to quantify the results because if it's based on mortgages process, because that's of value to the client, then you pay me for mortgages process.
Exactly.
In the IT world, I've been promoting this whole concept that we should be charging per productivity unit, like a function point or a use case point, because it puts the onus on the vendor to do things very differently from there onwards. Tomorrow I may make a change, as a customer I might make a change in requirements, but if it doesn't lead to a functionality change, the vendor does not get paid.
Right, exactly.
The vendor will push back, improve better processes, better requirements management models, and so on. And I think which will put the positive pressure on the system for every party to behave more effectively and efficiently.
And it occurs to me, actually, that some of the pushback that one reads, and certainly in the work that we've done, that we've seen, there is a tendency, I think, sometimes now for people to almost expect that as work is being done across the globe, that there is going to be some sort of lack of productivity as one extends one's relationship to many different countries and many different areas. And I suppose this is the sort of thing that reorients that to make sure that those people who are working in their sort of far off and far flung operations have the appropriate incentives to work as efficiently as possible.
Absolutely. And I think this is where my feeling is also that agreements over time, which many of the companies will sign, will change. Right now, it has been a lot of companies using their financial muscle to beat up on vendors. And I actually believe that the agreements don't reflect in many ways the corporate objectives that the company set out to. A business executive, when he wants to sign an agreement with a partner, he's looking for help in innovation, looking for best practices, and so on.
Yes.
On the other hand, by the time sourcing gets done with an agreement, you're measuring downtime, response time, and so on and so forth. And then you build a whole set of penalties and rewards around that. And therefore, automatically, the vendor management team starts focusing on that rather than the original business objective, which was the innovation, best practices, and those kinds of things. And I think, therefore, the contracting process has to undergo the most massive amount of re-engineering in these large companies to reflect the new reality.
That makes a lot of sense. Just out of curiosity, what has that process been like? Obviously, what you're talking about is fundamentally a paradigm shift. Granted, one that, as you point out, can be, I think, very accurately portrayed as something that benefits the client. But as you point out, there are several different moving parts of the process that we're talking about, everything from the procurement process, the contracting process, the development of the service level agreements. Is this something that you have found to be easy to convince your clients to use and to make these changes?
We have found where sourcing is more business-led, it's a lot easier to make these changes and to put together agreements where there is higher degrees of trust and mutual gain. If I look at some of the things which we talk about, the RBC agreement, right?
Mm-hmm.
There is significant incentive on both sides to achieve gain. And that's why both of us are working in each other's best interest. On the other hand, if the contract is not structured in such a way that both sides have incentives to make the other successful and both sides have incentives to improve the system, if it's structured like a beat-up kind of a contract, as I've seen in many cases, by the way,
mm-hmm.
unfortunately still so, to that extent, I think they find it that much more difficult to achieve anything other than the incremental improvements. So if you do a beat-up contract, you don't achieve order of magnitude changes in your workforce,
yes.
in your work style, and so on. You'll achieve some incremental stuff because that's what the SLAs focus on. Instead of 99% uptime, I want 99.3% uptime.
Exactly.
So that's what it is. You know, that's what I call the beat-up contracts are. And then there are ways by which, you know, you are actually partnering in innovation and trying to change the entire way in which you do your business, which can completely transform your cost structure, your customer service structure, and so on. And I think that is really where more and more of sourcing needs to understand how to structure those kinds of contracts and relationships.
Returning back to people, one of the things that I've been intrigued in preparing for this interview, Finish, obviously you've led a couple of different organizations now that have gone through dramatic growth, as we mentioned before, Infosys as well, of course, is in your current role at iGate. And I'm wondering how, especially for you in your current position as the head of the entire organization, as you're expanding into all of these new geographies, as the aggressive projections that the organization has for revenues are in place, needless to say, that needs to be fueled by increase in the workforce. And as you point out, an increase in many different areas of the world. How do you ensure that the quality of your resources is not watered down too dramatically as you continue this broad expansion?
I think there are two or three things. The first one is, I think without doubt, we have to accept that the raw material quality has changed over the last many years. If I look at India alone, in 1992, the entire industry used to hire about 100 people. And we had 200,000 engineering graduates who were coming out of the system. So we really had a choice, and we could apply any filter that we wanted, and somebody would pass through that filter. Fast forward it to 2008, the Indian education system is churning out roughly about 400, 410,000 engineering graduates. And the industry is employing about 175,000.
My goodness.
So we are now almost in a stage where it's 1 in 2, 1 in 2 and a half.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, from when you've gone from 1 in 2,000 to 1 in 2, clearly you have changed some of your filters. And therefore, it is my belief that it is very difficult to control the raw material quality, but you have to focus on controlling the end quality of what you're delivering to the client. And we have come up with what we are calling McDonald's. We're trying to come up with the McDonald's of the IT industry. Where in McDonald's, fundamentally what it shows you is that regardless of who's working on the front office, you get your product at a consistent level of service and quality. And regardless of how much attrition they have, regardless of what languages they broadly speak, you still end up getting a consistent level of quality. And therefore, we have come up with three major, what we call cocoons in iGATE. So the idea is to wrap the person who's coming out of engineering school in these cocoons such that their delivery will be very, very good in quality. So the first cocoon is really training. So regardless of where a person is coming from, even after we make an assessment, we actually subject that person to roughly 3.5 months of training, and regardless of which part of the world it is. So that way we actually bring them all to what I call a level base of iGATE processes, iGATE methodologies, iGATE language, and those kinds of things, so that in future productivity is much higher. So that when I talk about an error, that person also talks about the same meaning of an error.
Exactly. There's a standardization that happens, in other words.
Yeah, there's a standardization that happens. It brings everybody to the same page, so to speak. So that's 3.5 months training. That's the first cocoon we apply. The second one is actually the commitment that a company like iGATE has made to reuse and framework. So this is where I think the biggest investment, where we have ended up in a scenario where we try and make sure that people build less and less and use more and more of what is existing, and therefore learn to integrate more than learn to build. Because if I build more, I make more mistakes. And then there is all kinds of questions about the person's competence and those kinds of things. If I'm reusing, to that extent, I think it becomes a lot easier. And many companies, I think, have paid significant lip service to some of these terms in the past. But today, I think it's a business imperative. You don't have a choice.
Yes. And as I hear you talk, I'm hearing you pointing in a direction of service-oriented architecture, I believe.
I think you're right. It is a services-oriented architecture. And it's also a commitment to open source.
Yes, okay.
Because, you know, now more and more acceptance of open source is there, and so many objects are available in space, and so much of work has been done by everybody around the world. As long as you have a commitment to receive and publish, I think it's a good thing.
Yes.
And then the third cocoon that we have created in some sense is that we have created a very strong soft skills kind of program which enables our key interfaces with the client. And that's something which is, I think, very useful, because the kinds of skills that are needed are very different from maybe what we have trained many of these people to. Because in the past, IT people traditionally have lacked in what I call soft skills. I think most, whether it's in this market or any other market, we've all focused on hard skills. And yet we are now finding that soft skills can make a dramatic difference to the way projects run. To give you a simple example, the largest lever of a project and its cost and its success is not on how quickly you can code, but how well you manage the requirements. And that is largely a soft skills exercise, not a hard skills exercise. How do you build consensus between multiple points of view? How do you offer prescriptive thoughts rather than descriptive thoughts? How do you push back? How do you drive cost and value of requirements rather than just cost or just value, et cetera, et cetera? If you look at it, soft skills rather than hard skills.
Exactly. And in fact, if I'm also hearing you correctly, it's in some ways more broad business skills. I know that you focused a lot on, for example, having IT departments justify their work through return on investment, which not so long ago would have been considered to be a very difficult exercise.
Yes, you're right. I think you're absolutely right. I think people do, for some new projects, they try and build business cases.
Yes.
But there's a lot of work which I think many IT departments do, which are classically considered as, we have to do it. We don't know what the business case is.
Yes, exactly. Exactly right.
And I think that's something that we are trying to say, that we should come up with better frameworks for doing that. And we have come up with many other frameworks for doing many of these things.
Yes.
So I think dramatic changes on the people side, I would say, is what this is.
Very good. One last area that I wanted to ask you a question on, and that is, you've written and spoken a lot about the virtual enterprise, and I'm hearing you speak throughout this interview about a lot of the skills that are necessary, especially in terms of evaluating and measuring people based on their outcomes, which it seems to me becomes all the more essential for the virtual enterprise. I'm wondering about the transition to a virtual enterprise. How an organization who today largely has a traditional org structure and a traditional way of working, people in office spaces that are all together. How have you seen that transition work? Obviously, you've managed such a transition just in your roles within iGate and Infosys, but within a traditional corporation, a traditional large corporation, how have you advised your clients as they've thought about incorporating and developing indeed a virtual enterprise?
I think the first large piece is what I call a business blueprint of services. And this is something that we facilitate with all our clients, where we actually do executive workshops, where we try and build consensus on what are the things that a company must do over the next 5, 10, 20 years. What are the things that a company need not do, but must get done well? And what are the things that broadly in the category that it doesn't really make a business impact dramatically one way or the other. I'm going to give you a very classic example. If I look at, let's say, a mortgage company, somebody might turn around and say mortgage processing is actually core to us. And I try and separate that out, that word, to say what is competitive advantage and what is mission critical. So it may be mission critical to you, but it's not necessarily of competitive advantage to you. So we try and build these kinds of exec workshops where we try and build this consensus between the top line, 5 to 7 people, the CEO and his direct reports, as to what exactly they believe that the company should be doing in the future. That's the first step, just getting everybody to accept that on the page. Then I think after that, it becomes a lot easier, because once there is acceptance, then you can start laying down the step based on the risk profile of the company, based on the kinds of things that they are doing, based on the regulatory hurdles, based on all of those things. You can then start drawing different kinds of roadmaps with different timelines attached to them on how to achieve a desired end state. So I think the question is, you have an as-is state. We get consensus on the desired end state. And that desired end state may be 5 years down the line, 10 years down the line, whatever it is. I'm not worried about that. And then after that, we can actually start drawing a roadmap of how to achieve that. And all of this is based on business cases of better customer service, better profitability, and better time to market, because those we believe are absolutely key for company success in the long run. So that's how we kind of advise companies to go down this path.
That's great. Well, Finish, thank you so much for taking this time with us today. This has been a very insightful conversation, and we appreciate you sharing your views.
Thank you very much, Peter. It's a pleasure to talk to you, and if you need something, let me know.
Thank you.